Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Steve Heiner, a Canadian professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and a leader in the field of cultural psychology. In 2010, he, along with his colleagues Joseph Henrich and Ara Norenzayan, wrote the groundbreaking paper, The Weirdest People in the World, with weird meaning Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. The paper suggests that the view we have of the mind derived from the research of behavioral scientists is distorted due to the majority of studies in this field being done on only a small and not particularly representative sector of the human population. And this will be the topic of our conversation today. Well, hello, Steve. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Okay, well, could we begin, Steve, by you telling us a little bit about yourself and what prompted you, along with your colleagues, to write the paper?
Sure. So I'm a social psychologist and a cultural psychologist, and I'm interested in a variety of topics, but especially how our cultural experiences shape the ways that we think. Yeah. And I've done a lot of research on the self-concept and how the way that people think of themselves and then how they perceive the world varies quite a bit across cultures, with Westerners having a more individualistic sense of self, where the self is kind of who you are as an individual, and much of the rest of the world having more of a collectivistic sense of the self, is that the self is tied up with interpersonal networks and families and groups. And so in doing this research, I had always been struck with the idea that while Westerners are kind of unusual relative to the rest of the world, and this dimension, and that Americans seemed even more individualistic than other Westerners, and that American college students seemed especially individualistic. And this is something that I had always thought. And I have these two great colleagues, Joe Henrich and Ara Norenzayan, who also study culture, but from different perspectives. And Joe Henrich, who's an anthropologist by trade, and he studied a lot of motivations for fairness and cooperation. And he was noticing, too, that, wow, it's striking just how these motivations for fairness and cooperation more pronounced in some aspects among Americans than these many other anthropological or small-scale societies that he's been studying.
Yeah.
And Ara Norenzayan had been studying different ways of reasoning styles, whether people reason in a more analytic way or a more holistic way, and was struck, too, by how especially American college students seem to be unusual in how analytic their reasoning is compared to the rest of the world. And so we would have lunches regularly. We're just often talking about how each of the things that we study, like the American undergrads, are an outlier. And then it was actually Joe Henrich who originally proposed. He goes, well, why don't we, explore this more? And he said, and he had the title of the paper right from the very beginning, the weirdest people in the world, just because we seem so weird, these American undergrads in the ways that we were thinking. And we first thought, we're going to find maybe these are the only few phenomena where we find this pattern, and that we'll find other patterns where the way American undergrads are thinking aren't that unusual. And we went off and did this very time-consuming survey of the field, looking wherever we could find phenomena that have been studied in multiple cultures and just see how the different societies looked. And a very common pattern, not a universal pattern, but a very common pattern was that the American undergrads did stick out like a sore thumb here and were an outlier in a distribution. They had a more extreme way of thinking for many of the things that behavioral scientists are interested in. And we started realizing just how common this was, and then what a distorted understanding of human nature behavioral scientists must have because they've been studying such an unusual group.
Yeah, and then what percentage of these studies would you say are conducted on this group?
Well, so that was something that we were looking at the literature, and there's some people have been crunching the numbers, and it's really quite striking to me that about 70% of psychological studies are done with North Americans as their participants. And about 96% of them are done with Westerners as participants. And the vast majority of these, too, another 70% of this group, are done with college students. So especially with psychology research, and I think psychologists might be the worst offender here in this regard, is that the majority of our database is based on, well, American undergrads is the most overrepresented group. So by our calculations, the odds of an American undergrad ending up in a psychology study are about 4,000 times greater than the odds of a non-Westerner ending up in a psychology study. So it's just hugely overrepresented. And it's unusual in the sciences. There is a review across 20 different disciplines in science, and psychology is the outlier, having the largest percent of citations coming from American researchers. So that's about 70% for psychology. It's about 36% for chemistry. So it's curious just why such a large percent of psychologists are American, and the next biggest groups are British, Canadians, and Australians. So the top four countries in producing psychology research are all English-speaking countries, which in itself is a curious finding. But at least it shows that our understanding of human nature is very much dominated by our understanding of English-speaking Westerners. And this, you know, raises the question of, are our results generalizable? It's possible that the way the human mind works is the same everywhere. And I think this is what psychology has largely assumed, that one person's head is as good as anyone else's, that we all have the same basic brain. And so it doesn't really matter whose brains we study, we'll get the same answer, so we might as well study the most convenient ones. And the most convenient ones are university students who are attending the universities where the researchers are working, and just the most researchers are working in the U.S., and this leads to this very biased sample towards the American undergraduate. This wouldn't be a problem if the American undergraduate thought in the same ways that everyone else did. But the more you look at the data, the more you realize that, no, the American undergrad is an odd species indeed. It is an outlier in many respects in the ways that they think and perceive the world.
And what do you think is behind this bias? I mean, a term you could use presumably is cultural blindness. Yeah. I mean, is it just a basic heuristic? It's like a rule of thumb that we're applying, that you think if I think like this and the people around me think like this, then the chances are everyone else will.
Yeah, well, I think there is this, I have a pretty good idea of what's going on in my head. And when I meet someone, I don't really know what's going on in their head. But a strategy that I apply, and I think most people do, is you sort of project your own thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best I can imagine what's going on in your head is projecting what would be going on in my head if I was in your situation, right? So just assuming that you're sharing something similar, your experience is something similar to mine. And what I think makes this more problematic in the case of psychology is that as a psychologist, I share my research with other psychologists. You know, I go to conferences and meet these people who are studying similar topics, and we're all finding the same pattern of results. And everyone I talk to, we're all finding the same kind of thing and not realizing that everyone I'm talking to is also sharing my cultural background for the most part, that psychology is so Western dominated, especially American dominated, not realizing that all these other instances where I'm seeing people who are studying the same kind of phenomena, but they're studying the same kinds of samples too. And so you get this sort of false sense of security that, yes, this must be universal. Everyone I talk to is finding the same kinds of things, but not realizing that everyone I'm talking to shares my cultural background.
Interesting. Okay. And what about arguably the still fairly common assumption that our brains function in a similar way to a computer? Has that played a part too, do you think?
Yes, I think it very much has. So, I mean, we rely on metaphors a great deal to understand something, that we try to understand something in terms of what it reminds us of, something familiar. And the brain is this, extremely complex, abstract entity here for us to understand how it works. And probably the closest thing to a brain is a computer. Closest familiar thing to a brain is a computer. And so we can say, oh, well, we can understand how a computer works and we can map this out. And a computer is just like a brain. And so using this as this metaphor, the mind as a machine, the mind as a computer is useful for generating, you know, hypotheses and for having an understanding about the brain. But a key problem with it is there's many ways that brains are not like computers. And the key difference is that for a computer, the hardware is fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Hardware doesn't change, but brains do change,
yeah.
and they change in response to experiences. When you learn something new, you have new neuronal wiring growing there. There's new synapses being formed, that your brain is changing. Each experience that you have changes the nature of your brain. And if your culture's, one way of thinking about cultures, they're providing you with a set of experiences. And if cultures are providing people with very different sets of experiences, it's going to shape the ways that they think. It's ultimately going to shape their brains differently. And so the real weakness of this brain as a computer metaphor, as useful as it is in simplifying this very complex, you know, organ of the brain, it's also very biased in the sense that it suggests that we should expect all brains to look the same, because that the hardware should be unimpacted by the very different circumstances that people live in. But that's just not true. That people live in different circumstances, they have different experiences, and this comes to shape their brains differently. That's the key difference with a computer.
So these experiments that have molded our understanding of the human mind, such as the Milgram shocks, the Stanford Prism experiments, the Piaget stages of development, even potentially Daniel Kahneman's research on cognitive biases, etc., they've almost entirely been done on weird people, more specifically American college students then.
Yes, the bulk of psychological phenomena. Actually, the Milgram experiment is one that's been done in quite a few countries.
And does that stack up?
Yeah, and it actually, everywhere it's been done, you see a strong bias towards obedience. Actually, that's the original reason why Milgram did that study, was he thought there was something with the German character that led them to be so obedient, to help explain, you know, the events of World War II. And he thought he would first try it out with an American sample, because he was at Yale University, and then he's going to take it to Germany. And he was expecting Germany was where they're going to obey. And then he found out, well, Americans all obey as well. So it's kind of started, well, this seems to be a very widespread phenomena. But most psychological phenomena aren't studied in a broad context of places, because I think with our metaphor of the mind as a computer, just hasn't made it an important question that people would ask, that they would find a particular psychological bias demonstrated in a lab with American undergrads. And the assumption that they would have is they've discovered something about human nature, that they've discovered this phenomenon of, true of the human mind. And rarely would people ask, are there contexts where this bias doesn't exist? There aren't many incentives to ask this question too, because it's much easier doing a study with convenient samples than it is with less convenient ones that might exist on the opposite side of the world. So I think it was always within our own interests, just as a field, that, you know, often ask questions that are easily answerable. And so one of the questions that didn't come up so often was, would this phenomenon be true elsewhere? Now that's becoming a more common question that people are asking, thankfully, that there does seem to be a growing awareness that a lot of psychological processes do vary across the world. Not all of them. There's many human universals too.
Yeah.
But we've never had a way of determining beforehand which phenomena were likely to be universal and which ones were likely to be culturally variable. And so instead, it seems that the field had embraced this assumption that we're going to assume something is universal until proven otherwise.
Okay, well, could we have a look now at some of the examples how, you know, the weird group differ from people from other cultures? Like, you talked about a lot of your background is in looking at aspects of the self. Could we look at the notion of self-esteem and how that differs maybe cross-culturally? Because you did a study with Japan, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I've done quite a bit of research contrasting Japanese motivations for self-esteem compared with North American ones. And yet, motivations for self-esteem are considerably stronger in North America. I think it's part of being an individualistic self is having a positive view of yourself. I mean, to the extent that you think of yourself as all tied up within the individual, so that you are who you are as an individual, you need to be self-sufficient to take care of yourself, that these kinds of thoughts are aided by having a positive view of yourself, to think of yourself as good enough to take care of oneself, as mattering to the world, as being of significance. And in a more collectivistic context, it's not as important to focus on what is positive about yourself. And I think especially in the Japanese case, and I actually think that Japanese might be an outlier on this dimension in the other direction, that we haven't seen as self-critical results outside as results as self-critical as we find in Japan. But in Japan, we find that people are much more likely to elaborate on shortcomings of themselves, that dwelling on, focusing on things that they can't do well enough, because they tend to view abilities as much more fluid and changeable than Westerners do. So if you want to be a good person, the way of doing it in Japan is to find out ways that you might not be doing well enough and work towards correcting them. And so this is fostered by having this self-critical outlook and not having high self-esteem, instead just being very aware of all the shortcomings that you have, being very aware of the kinds of aspects of yourself that might lead to disapproval from others. So where might you stand to ultimately to lose face, which is a big concern in Japan. And so to work towards correcting any potential shortcomings that you might have, so that you're gonna be more likely to maintain face.
Okay, that poses an interesting question for me, Steve, because I spent many years as a TEFL teacher, or what you might call a TESOL teacher. Yeah. And I had many situations where I had Japanese students and students from Western cultures in my classes. So, you know, so in terms of motivating my students from this research, there's no right answer for motivation. It depends very much on the mind I'm trying to motivate them as a teacher, isn't it?
That's right. I think there are few strategies that work universally around the world. That I think, you know, if you want to motivate someone, you need to understand what is motivating for them. And what our research has shown that, yeah, Japanese will be more motivated by pointing out a weakness that they have, where Westerners are more motivated when you point out a strength that they have. That Westerners will work harder and will do better when they have confidence in their ability. And we find Japanese will work harder and will do better when they feel that they're not doing well enough.
Okay.
And so, yeah, if you want to motivate people, you need to, you know, target your feedback for whatever motivational system is more pronounced for that person. The tricky thing is, though, is just because someone is a member of a culture doesn't mean that they have a prototypical way of thinking of that culture. That every culture has a lot of diverse individuals in them, right? That's, you know, that the people around you aren't all the exact same as you, that people have different views and different opinions. So the challenge with this is you actually have to get to know a person well enough to know whether they tend to have more of a self-critical motivation or more of a self-enhancing, self-esteem-building motivational system.
I suppose that's the sort of thing you would endeavor to do anyway, really. But it's
yes.
Still very helpful, all this stuff, to just have it in the background.
Yeah.
And then your colleague Joseph, you're right, saying that his specialized area was fairness. Well, something that he focused on was fairness. How did fairness differ?
So this comes from this work in economics. And the question is, well, how is it that human societies are unique in the animal kingdom, where we have a lot of strangers living together and cooperating? That, you know, for the most part, you can walk down the street where you live and people won't try to hurt you, that you can, you know, if you need to get some food, you know how, you know, you reach an agreement that you'll pay a certain price and you'll get the food that you want, that you have a society that largely functions. And in the animal kingdom, this is a hard thing to understand, because there aren't other species of a lot of unrelated individuals cooperating with each other. So economists were wanting to figure out how this could be with humans, and they're proposing, well, maybe the case is that humans have this innate desire for fairness and cooperation, and it's because of that, this innate desire to cooperate, that we can have these societies. And so the way this research was done originally, they would have people play an economic game. One of them is called a dictator game, and the way it works is you'd have two people, one person called a proposer and another person called a receiver, and the proposer is given some money, real money. They're given like $10, and they're told, you can give this receiver any amount of your money that you wish. You're never going to meet this person. This person will never know who you are. It's up to you how much money should you give to this person. And from an economic perspective, the proposer should give the receiver nothing. Like, why should they engage in this costly transaction of giving up something that they have without getting any return, all anonymously? It just doesn't make sense. But this is what people do. That's what they kept in these days. And people would typically give about half of their money. That half seems fair. The idea that, well, I could have been the receiver and not the proposer. And if I was the receiver, I would have liked to the proposer had given me half of the money. And so there's a sense that, yeah, people have this innate motivation for fairness, and that's what allows them to cooperate. However, all of this research was done with American undergrads for the most part, also with some Swiss undergrads. And what Joe Henrich did was he took the same dictator game to 15 societies around the world, small-scale societies. And he found out everywhere you play, you get a different answer. And the most fairness that you get is with American undergraduates. And you get much less degrees of this fairness elsewhere. And the best predictor of whether you play the game fairly is how much experience you've had in a market economy. If you're used to engaging in a market economy, you're going to have strong motivations for fairness. And so if you're not used to engaging in a market economy, you're not going to have such strong motivations for fairness. So this actually turns the causal story completely around. It's not that humans can cooperate and have markets because they're innately fair. It's that people are fair, have motivations to be fair, because they've experienced markets and had this exchange of goods with other people. And they learn that a market, you can benefit a lot from the market, provided that people play fair. And it's through learning this that you actually acquire this stronger motivation for fairness and cooperation.
Could you imagine that would be a very useful piece of knowledge for the Republican Party?
Yes. Yeah, that you think they would be all over that.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe they'd be a bit disturbed at the idea that life is people are motivated to be fair.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, and then your other colleague, he focused more on reasoning. Could you tell us a little bit about analytic versus holistic reasoning?
Yes. So for the most part in history of psychology, when people studied reasoning, we were studying analytic reasoning. And analytic reasoning is coming to understand something by doing a few things. One, breaking it down into smaller and smaller parts. So like if I want to understand why a fish behaves the way that it does, you know, I'll ultimately want to understand, oh, well, what are the different parts of its brain or the different parts of its body that is going to propel the fish or motivate the fish to achieve certain things. And that's how you'd understand something, by looking at its component parts. And you also understand something by thinking of what are the rules that apply to those parts, that what are the sort of abstract rules that any type of object must obey to be able to function. And that's largely the way that reasoning was understood. And this kind of reasoning is very well developed with especially the American undergrad. This is how you learn to reason by participating in higher education for the most part. However, much of the rest of the world also engages in another kind of reasoning. Well, actually, American undergrads do this too, but not to the same degree, kind of holistic reasoning. And holistic reasoning is where you try to understand how something works by the context that it's in. Mm-hmm. So if you want to understand how a fish is working, you'd want to look at, well, what are the other fish around it doing? You know, that you swim together with a school of fish, that the behavior of something is being influenced by the context, by others around it.
Yeah.
And an example then of these different reasoning styles can be seen in the ways that people perceive scenes. If you look at a scene, what do you look at? And typically the way that American undergrads look at a scene is that they look at it as a bunch of separate objects. And you can see this in the way that their eyes move through a scene from one object. They focus on one object for a while, then they might shift over and look at another object for a while. When you present the same kinds of scenes, for instance, to a Chinese audience, they are looking at the objects and they're looking at the background, and they seem very much to be perceiving the scene as an integrated whole, as a bunch of parts all woven together instead of a bunch of separate parts that exist. And so this analytic reasoning is more common among American undergrads than among Americans who don't have an undergrad education. It's more common among Americans than it is among other Westerners. And it's more common among people from Western societies than it is from people from non-Western societies. And so there are these two competing ways of perceiving and understanding the world, this analytic orientation and this holistic orientation. And the American undergrad focuses most of their reasoning on this analytic way of perceiving and making sense of the world, and not attending much to this more of this holistic way of perceiving and understanding the world, whereas this holistic way is far more common in the rest of the world.
Just out of interest, Steve, what do you think has made Westerners more individualistic than other cultures? Because, as you say, this more individualistic way of thinking is more the outlier. Could it be the Enlightenment, the pursuit of happiness in the American Constitution, something like that?
I do think it's very much a historical event, that it's something that did seem to grow across time. If I had to put a single event that at least made the U.S. unusual, I do think it's that the first waves of immigrants to the U.S., the Puritans were Calvinists. And having actually a very extreme version of Protestantism that they brought to the U.S. that formed the first Western society in the Americas. And the Protestantism that they brought emphasized a number of points that weren't embraced before to the same degree. The idea that individuals have a direct one-to-one relationship with God, that it's not that the church communicates to God for you, that the church takes care of you. No, that you have an individual relationship with God, and that you also have a calling. The idea that, each person has their own sort of individual purpose on earth that they're supposed to fulfill. And that, Protestantism emerged in Europe, but it had to compete with the existing Catholicism that was already there. And so it was an outgrowth from that. Whereas in the U.S., it didn't have as much competition with other faiths. So it became the dominant faith. And I think that was one event that really sort of accelerated this idea of individuals are unique and independent, sort of self-contained agents. And that's developed much more so in the U.S. and elsewhere. But I think you're right that events of the Enlightenment sort of also encouraging this idea that humans were not so much bound to tradition, were not so much bound to communities, but were individual agents pursuing their own goals.
Right. So what resistance, Steve, and concerns to your argument have you come across? So, you're 5 years in now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this paper has gotten more attention than any other paper I've worked on before. Although I have to admit that most of the attention has come from outside psychology. I think it's been embraced more outside of psychology because it is quite, if the field of psychology is to change, to be more globally focused, to be more concerned with what I would call our concerns with external validity, that is, concerns with the extent that findings, psychological findings in one context look the same as findings in another context. For psychology to do this properly, it would have to change in a lot of ways. It would have to, researchers would need to get more experience in working with those from other cultures, of forming international collaborations, of getting hard to reach expensive samples. And these are big challenges for the field. So We found in general that the people that embrace our paper most strongly aren't psychologists, aren't the ones who are having actually to face these kinds of changes in their discipline. I think these shortcomings of psychology relying on narrow samples are quite obvious to the rest of the social sciences, because concerns of representativeness are much more commonly shared in some other fields, such as in sociology and anthropology and in political science, for instance. And they haven't been big concerns in psychology. And so we've had some pushback from some of our colleagues in psychology. I was quite worried in first time I went to a conference after having written the paper with if anyone was going to sit beside me at lunch. And the first talk that I gave, actually, it was one of the emptier rooms that I've given a talk in, just after our paper was published and giving this talk. So I think the field has mixed feelings about it. I think in general, people can recognize that, yes, it's true that we have a narrow sample size, and it might be the case that American undergrads are not the most representative sample for many kinds of phenomena, but it's also a very challenging problem to correct, for the field to correct, especially in the context of another challenge that our field is facing right now. You may have encountered there's been a lot written recently on how a lot of psychology findings don't replicate well. Actually, something that's true of many sciences, that replication is becoming more of a concern. And so one of the strategies of making research more replicable is, well, having larger samples. So rather than running a study with 50 people, running a study with 200 people.
Yeah.
Rather than just doing the study once, doing it three times to show that it's a really reliable finding. And all of these things actually incentivize more convenient samples, though.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a force working directly at odds with our goal to get psychology to consider more seriously the concerns with external validity, concerns of how well do our findings generalize elsewhere, to these other concerns with what we call internal validity. How much can we trust the findings that we already have that we found? How well will those replicate just if we do the study again in the same context? That's become a concern now. So I think that's a force that our message is battling against right now, is that I think many ways these concerns with making sure that our studies are showing what we think they're studying is at odds with concerns for, well, how well might these findings generalize in other places, that it's hard to attend to both of these at the same time, because the best way of doing so would just be having much larger samples, so much larger groups of people that would address the concerns with the replicability. And then, though, to address the concerns with how well does it generalize, we'd have to have many more of these large samples in far-flung places around the world. And those are clearly challenging for the field to deal with.
Sure. Okay. And then at a personal level, how can we try to avoid, this cultural blindness? How can we get a more broader view from our own personal perspective?
Well, I think it's... I was happy to see someone once did a study of what happens to students when they take a class in cultural psychology, and they lose the sense of culture blindness is sort of a take-home message of this finding, that when you come to realize that people around the world might have different concerns, different perspectives, different values, and this becomes salient to you, you're not as quick to just project your own egocentric view of the world onto others, realizing that people from other contexts have different thoughts in their head. They have different concerns and different priorities. And I think just reminding yourself of this fact can go a long ways, because then it means what you have to do is you have to listen more.
Sure.
You can't just assume that what you're thinking is the same as what I'm thinking. No, I actually have to sit and listen more to what you're saying to come to understand how it is that you're viewing the world, that it might not be the same as the way that I'm viewing the world.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on my own experience here, Steve. I spent most of my adult life abroad, and I remember when I was in my 20s, I was living in Germany, and there were some very big events in British history at the time. There was the Falklands War and also the miners' strike. And I got a very different perspective of it from living in Germany, and was able to have a lot more arguably balanced view of what was going on from my own cultural perspective just through living abroad.
Yeah, well, I think that's Seymour Martin Lipset was a political sociologist, and he would say, if you only understand one country, you understand no countries, in the sense that you often come to realize something about your own culture, your own country, from seeing it from another country's point of view. That by learning about more than one country, you all of a sudden become aware of, well, what is the set of historical background that led, you know, people in my country to have the perspectives that they have, and encountering another culture, and especially if you can live there and really come to understand it well, really gives you a very different perspective on your own country and of the world then. And it just broadens your perspective, and you realize that there's many different ways of being human. There's many different contexts that people live in. And I think there's really nothing better than experience with people from other cultures or living in other places to give you that perspective.
Sure. Okay. And this might sound an obvious statement or question, Steve, but like the middle way, as we understand it in the society, is the idea that if you avoid fixed beliefs about things, and they could be dogmatic views or cognitive biases or whatever, you can arguably make better decisions. Now, how does that potentially relate to what we've been talking about today?
That's interesting. Yeah, I think if you become aware that there's more than one way of doing things, there's more than one way of seeing the world, that this makes you more open and more flexible. There's this interesting research by some American psychologists named Will Maddox and Adam Galinsky, where they show that people who've lived in multiple cultures become more creative. And the idea is that because they are seeing the world from more than one perspective. And by seeing it in more than one perspective, you actually can make some new connections that you might not otherwise have made. And so there's many instances too of, you know, famous artists who have lived in multiple cultures. You can think of Hemingway was living in France, Picasso lived in both Spain and France, Handel in both Germany and the UK. There's many instances like this. And there might be something to this. Having exposure to more than one way of seeing the world gives you this flexibility to take different perspectives about yourself and to see the world differently. And there's a lot of benefits, such as creativity or tolerance or an openness to change that you can get from these experiences.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, and my last question, Steve, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
The best thing to do, I think, would just be to Google my name, Steven, and my last name is Heine, Heine, and you will see a link to my website where I have all of my publications listed, and one of those is The Weirdest People in the World.
Okay, well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Steve. Thanks very much.
Great. Well, thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.